presentation, I'll give you some background information. I'll go over a circuit description of what I designed, some of the microprocessor code and algorithms that I worked on, the evolution of the design, and then the conclusions and some future work that could be done on this project. Some background information is last summer, another co-op got to work on these bots right here. And those were designed for a controls branch that is doing research in swarm control algorithms. So they have an RF link with the antenna, but they also built in a capacitive coupling collision avoidance technique where these upper and lower bands are transmitters and the middle band is a receiver. So it senses an electric field of another robot nearby, and it'll avoid that. And that's just another information for controlling a swarm. Well, my mentors thought it would be really cool that instead of just sensing collision, if they could actually transmit information using that electric field. So that's where my project came from. One of the problems with this capacitive coupling is the signal size. It's pretty small compared with the noise in the environment. Just the 60 hertz field from power cords nearby, they affect it a lot. And the motor noise on the robots themselves, it's pretty horrendous for these signals. So we need to do a lot of design to do that, to overcome those obstacles. But some of the good things about it is that this is non-contact, so nothing needs to actually touch for these to interact. And it's low power because it's not going to use as much. It's not going to lose power unless it's actually transmitting. And it's also not RF, so it's not going to interfere with any other bands around. Some of the other uses that they envisioned besides this robot communication is also to instrument humans. They thought they might use a human as a dielectric for different instruments around the body, and it won't interfere with any RF coming off, an astronaut, because they use a lot of different bands of information for all the data. So to accomplish this, me and my fellow co-op, we designed a capacitive coupling communication node. Shown here is a master and slave, but they're actually the same circuit. They perform the same function. It's just a different firmware load that changes it. And to accomplish the actual task, we built a lock-in amp front end that would filter out any extraneous signals. And then we used a microprocessor to help with the lock-in amp and also to provide some signal conditioning and the communications protocol, which uses the serial UART on board the microprocessor, and also to transmit the actual data that's going to be of use. Our project had three goals but it was supposed to be powered by a 3-volt battery. We aimed for a 1 kilobit per second data rate. We also wanted to have the smallest footprint possible on a circuit board that we could, and an 18.6 kilohertz carrier frequency, because that's what the robots had previously used. And we also wanted to demonstrate the operation of the circuit in different environments, noisy environments near motors with noise injected. Okay, a lock-in amp. I don't know how many of you are familiar with lock-in amps, but I wasn't really. And this is a pretty, I guess, common circuit to use in optical applications. Basically, all an op-amp does is a one frequency Fourier transform. And you can look at it a couple different ways. All an op-amp does is multiply one cosine or one sinusoid signal by the incoming signal, and if the incoming signal matches the frequency you're looking for, you can low pass filter it, and you'll output a DC value when that frequency is present. So we basically accomplish this with switching between a plus one and a minus one at the frequency we're looking for, and then we low pass filter it. And so you can look at it in the frequency domain where you convolve a cosine with a square wave, and you end up with this sync pulses. And if you low pass filter that, you're going to end up with just a band around the DC level.
How many people in here are in 351? It's a very narrow band AM radio. It's a synchronous AM radio. So.
Okay, so that's how the lock-in amp works. And this is the circuit that we designed to actually accomplish that. We have two inverter op-amps, which take the plus one and the minus one signals. And then we have two switches that switch, multiplying it by the cosine or sine, whatever we're looking for, We chose to do a cosine and sine because we can't guarantee that these signals are going to be in phase. So by doing this, we get an in-phase and a quadrature component, which we can actually pull out the original signal from. These circuits at the end here are sound key low-pass filters. They're just second-order low-pass filters, just to provide the filtering technique from the lock-in amp. So, shown here is some oscilloscope readings. We have an input waveform, inverted, and then inverted again. Shown here is our switching wave. And if you look at this, it's multiplying it by plus one for this section, and then minus one, it's flipping it for the next section, and it does that. And then so that would be our I, and then this one is actually 90 degrees out of phase switched, so that would be our Q. And those are getting fed into the low-pass filters. So outside here, we have our carrier frequency going in, an 18.5, and then we get an in-phase and a quadrature component coming out. And that should be a DC level, but because of the phase is moving, we actually see a sine wave and a cosine wave coming out. Shown here is when it's right on, we can see actually two DC components coming out of the lock-in amp filter. And it's difficult to see, but this one's a negative. This one's a negative value, and this one's actually a positive value. So this is shows that it's zero. The actual output is zero because the frequency is 205 kilohertz. It's not anywhere near the frequency we're looking at. And shown here is the on-off keying, which we're going to use to actually communicate so we can use the serial UART. So we on-off key our carrier frequency, our 18.5 kilohertz, and we can see the bits coming out of the low-pass filter, which we're going to have to perform signal conditioning to actually get any information in the microprocessors. Shown here just is the input to the low-pass and the output from the low-pass. So you can see all the high-frequency components are filtered out, and we can actually see our bits. And we have our I and our Q. So at some point, one of them may be zero, and that's when the other one's going to be maximum. So that's why, if it's not in phase, we need to look at both signals so we can get all the information back out. So what we want to do here is take the output from these two signals, and we want to sample them with an A to D for our microcontroller to generate our bit stream for our microprocessor. So this is just a little diagram that we have our on-off keying, and then we have waveforms that are kind of charging and discharging from the low-pass filter, and those are sampled by the A to D, and then we do some signal conditioning, and we output a digital waveform, and we pipe that back into the UART. And we use the UART because it frames the data for us into bytes, and it makes it a lot more simpler to use. This is the signal conditioning that's done in the microprocessor to take that input bit stream and actually change it to a digital bit stream. This took a lot of progress to actually accomplish this, because it's kind of difficult, because the gain of the signal will change depending on how near the plates are to each other. And if we added automatic gain, that would add a lot more complication to our system, maybe make our circuit footprint a lot bigger. So we chose some way to overcome that. So if our threshold was right on, this is how our output would look. But if our signal got bigger, we might start to see some glitches in it. And then if our signal got smaller, then we'll see the threshold move in the opposite direction. We'll see even more glitches. So to overcome that, we came up with a peak detector algorithm. And while this isn't perfect, it does overcome a lot of the obstacles. We just sample the value, and we set that, if it's larger than our last peak value, we'll make that our new peak, and then we let it fall off linearly as time goes on. And so that gets rid of the low glitches and the high glitches and somewhere in between. But there are going to be times when that could be saturated, just because we're confined to our 3-volt power supply, which only leaves 1.5 volts on each side of the rail for the op amps. So this was our solution to it, and it worked out pretty well. Shown here is the output of the waveform. The input is shown in the purple. We have a no noise injected, some high frequency, and some low frequency noise. The blue, the turquoise, shows the trigger for that waveform.
One pointer for those waveforms.
The blue shows the trigger for this purple waveform. So that's what we should see coming out of the microprocessor, which is the yellow. So, and that's pretty much what we have. We got rid of a lot of the glitches using the peak detector. But there is some phase lag. And the faster the bit rate we use, the more phase lag we have. But this really isn't a problem with serial communication for the baud rates we're going at. This phase lag, it turned out to be okay. The communications protocol we designed, it's a pretty simple design. We have a master and a slave, and we can have multiple slaves. And the master just requests data from the slave. So the master will send a packet with a header. We just chose AA. And then it'll send the slave number for which slave it's looking for, and then a checksum value. And the slave just sits in its idle state waiting to hear any information. If it hears its slave number, then it checks the packet for any errors and for what the data it's asked for. Then it transmits that data back. And it transmits its slave number, so the master knows which slave is giving back the information, the data, and a checksum, so the master itself can check that. Now, we hooked up some simple potentiometers and different things to the slave, and some of them we just hard-coded values in so we could just check to make sure it's talking. And we tested this around different areas. We actually transmitted through the human body. We transmitted around all our robots just to make sure that we were actually getting the data we were supposed to. And it worked pretty well. We had some problems though looking at the code actually in the microprocessor, because the development environment we were given would never update any of the watch variables. So it was kind of difficult to actually look in the registers and make sure every packet was accurate. But as far as we could tell, it works well. Now, this is the design evolution. This is the development board for the microprocessor, and this is the lock and amp circuit. And as you can see, there's a lot of traces. And as the circuit got bigger and more complex, these traces just got out of control, and we started getting a lot of interference and coupling between the different phases. And also, we were using a 5-volt power supply. In our final design, we wanted to go with a 3-volt battery power supply so that these were actually decoupled from different power supplies. So we moved to a printed circuit board design. This is a PCB Express printed circuit board layout that I did. The lab actually has its own milling machine to mill out printed circuit boards, and they use a proprietary ProTel software. So we didn't actually use this. This was smaller than the ProTel board because the mill is actually larger than what PCB Express can do. But this shows the printed circuit board that we milled out and had laid it out in the lab. And you can see the two paddles. Well, I don't know if you can see them. But there's two paddles for the capacitive plates so they can communicate. Here's the battery hookup, and this is just a programming jumper so that we can actually program the microprocessor. When we were experimenting with the human body, it got kind of unruly, this whole apparatus. So we laid out a SolidWorks design and had a 3D printer print out this package here where the circuit board sat on top and the battery sat in this little area, and we could strap this to an arm so that we didn't have to worry about all these plates. So the conclusions, we ended up with a working circuit tuned to about 18.5 kilohertz and a 1 kilobit per second bit rate with a 3-volt power supply. We demonstrated communication through capacitive coupling with noise injected in different environments. We also minimized the circuit onto a printed circuit board, and we integrated it into a package with a power supply. Some future work that might be looked at is to modify the package and integrate it with robots. Also, we might want to experiment with the ground coupling, which we noticed was kind of difficult depending on the area it's in. All these units have to actually couple with the ground so that the charge can transfer back to the other units. So that was kind of a problem. Sometimes we needed to use a bigger plate or actually let it actually touch a solid object to allow the charge to transfer. So that's one thing that should be experimented with. I'd like to thank Jennifer Napier, my fellow co-op, Larry Greer, who's my mentor, Mike Krasowski, who was Jennifer's mentor, Danny Spina, he's the lab technician that did a lot of our soldering and milled our boards, and then Joe Fatico, another lab engineer that added some technical advice. Any questions?
You talked about you laying out a circuit board.
Yes.
And you used we a number of times. What besides the circuit board was your particular responsibilities?
I designed the firmware in the microprocessor. I worked on designing the circuit. I worked a lot with another co-op on almost everything. The other circuit board was laid out by the lab technician because it was on his computer, the software. He did that, and he milled the boards for us, and he did some of the soldering just because that's his area of expertise. That's what he gets paid for. I laid out this other one just to get some experience and in case they ever actually got some funding to have somebody else actually manufacture the boards. Yes.
So why did you go with a separate lock-in detector rather than just having, you know, like say maybe a filter circuit go straight to an A to D and the microprocessor do it all in digital?
Well, we envisioned maybe in the future that to use lower power, we might lower the microprocessor clock. And so we were worried that we might have some issues if we did it all in digital signaling just because it might be a power hog. This was a lot more power efficient. And also it was just a practice in design, analog design, you know, as a co-op.
Any other questions back there? Did you look at the analog implementation using the analog analog devices lock-in chip?
No.
They do make a lock-in chip.
Really? We didn't look at that. We did look
but
at...
But they cost, like, I think $95. But, you know, this is NASA, so you could probably afford it.
Yeah, right. we had to build most of this stuff with stuff we had in the lab because they weren't able to make any orders for parts.
Spec.
Yeah.
Okay. Using what's available.
Right.
And just a comment, by the way, for everyone else in the class, the business about milling printed circuit boards, that is actually a very common technique, particularly when you want to do an antenna on the printed circuit board. Now, the question is, why? Well, the reason is, printed circuit board houses, like, you know, PC Express or whatever, they're all set up to deal with ordinary fiberglass printed circuit boards. RF printed circuit boards are not done on fiberglass. They're done on Teflon. Okay? Why? Because the dielectric losses are way, way, way too high at RF frequencies for printed circuit boards. And so what you get into is the wonderful world of strip lines, transmission lines, and, you know, all of those funny-looking things that you see if you take open your cell phone and want to rewire it or something. Those are all microwave circuits. And we actually have a milling machine system here with the software on the fifth floor of Glenn. If anyone needs to make an antenna on a printed circuit board, and students can get free Teflon printed circuit board material from a company, I can put you in touch with them. They'll just send you tons of stuff for a student project. But normally, it's something like, I think the prices are a couple dollars a square inch for the printed circuit board material. So that's just FYI. And by the way, a lock-in can actually operate with a negative signal-to-noise ratio for those of you who are into communications. You can tell it is an optical physics branch, and physicists use lock-in amplifiers. We don't typically know what they are, but they're designed very, very narrow band, extract out a signal from a very high signal-to-noise ratio, or rather, a very, very low signal-to-noise ratio environment. And a commercial lock-in amplifier will typically have input sensitivities going down to a nanovolt or less. But bandwidth is also going to be a millihertz. So these are some interesting issues that you can get into in your communications course. Be on Buckner when he gets back from L.A. Okay. Very nice job, Mark. Very cool. We should have invited Newman in here so he could hear about this for the robot hockey team. Or for the Lego course, because this is an alternative to provide communications that's not RF. Although, I'm not going to give the class a quiz on what is the difference between a capacitive coupling and an electromagnetic wave. I'll let you think about what you know from fields and what the difference is. And you're off the hook. I'm not going to ask you that one either. Okay. Well, first thing I want do is hand that midterm or interim technical reports. We're going to give, we'll write up a synopsis of how we grade it and why. But my usual philosophy is I grade much harder at midterm than I do at the end of the semester. Although that's not always the case. But a lot of projects, I think, right now are making progress, which isn't accounted for by the numerical grades. Okay? We just did a numerical thing for midterm. Okay, so I'm just going to call these out and distribute them. Dance lamp? Okay. Oops. Let's see. This one must be all part. Okay. And the monitoring marker. Nope. Gun target. Okay. Jack stack. Well written. Let's see. Which one's this one? Random number. There you are. Pacemaker. Okay, you're going to go over there. Okay, shock sensor. Okay, bandage. Okay. Medical phone monitor. By the way, Microsoft just put out an RFP for telemedicine using cell phones. I'll send you a copy of it. But aren't we kindly? Okay, 2D means here. Okay. Ryan Tess.
Oh, yeah.
Mesh networks. That's what the new television. I don't know why I keep wanting to say the new radio. Check, because sometimes there's so much work with this course I forget. Have you gotten feedback now from every assignment that you've turned in? Okay. Because from here on out, if you listen to what we've been telling you, it should almost be like cruise control for your writing, your presentations, and everything else. You have a first draft of every one of them. So we're expecting the next ones to be so good that they'll all be A's. Okay? And that's not outside the bounds of possibility. We've done a lot, I think, to give you a tremendous amount of feedback. Now, remember, though, what we said at the very beginning of the semester. What are the reasons why projects don't get an A or a B? One, you don't work on the project.
Or you don't work enough.
Or you don't work enough. That's a very important thing. Okay? And the second is that you never got a coherent management plan together and are following your plan. Okay? Sometimes you'll go off on tangents, do other things, whatever. If there are any issues or problems which are occurring with your project, you should contact one of us immediately. We are not necessarily, notice that, not necessarily evil ogres. Okay? So if you have any issues, any problems, anything unforeseen comes up, let us know. Your written reports were heavily edited by yours truly. I went through
every page of 360 pages of stuff. And we're hoping that this will result in better stuff. Okay, darn it. Okay, first thing is, if you've looked at the calendar, next week are oral status reports again. Okay, you should have all kinds of stuff now from your interim report. Basically, all you're going to do is update them. And we will start with the people who didn't get to present in class. Okay, and then we'll have the random drawing to see if we don't get everyone in. There is going to be one tiny additional new requirement. This is documented on the web page. Okay, and let's hope that this opens and works well. Something called a quad chart. This is used increasingly in academia, industry, and especially government. If you deal with DARPA, if you deal with the Army Research Office, if you deal with anything, you do a chart like this. And the breakdown is we have instructions as to what you put in each quadrant. And I'm going to show you a couple examples in a moment. And the examples are on the web page. Norman, did you see any of these at NASA? Okay, there they tend to put more budget-type stuff on their quad charts. They're more driven by budgets. We're not going to put any budgets, but basically this will be a fifth slide in your presentation. It'll be at the end. You don't have to say very much about it, but it's in essence a PowerPoint executive summary of your project. All right, see, everything's moving over to PowerPoint. Eventually you will not need to do complete sentences about anything. Okay, the upper left quadrant is where you put all of the title information. This is basically your first slide. What you put in the upper right quadrant is what the project is. Okay, this is usually the title and maybe some very simple background. Notice, there isn't a lot of room, and I'll show you how creative you can be with examples in a moment. Down here is what you've got done. These are your results in the lower left. And then finally, the right lower is usually for what we call the wow factor. This is where you put in photos. This is where you put anything. Now, what they do mostly at NASA is they put budget charts on there. Instead of us doing, you know, a Gantt chart, they'll usually have a chart that shows planned expenditures and how close you're tracking planned expenditures. Real accounting. We're not doing that in this course at all, but organizations do this. Okay, so this template, by the way, is on the web page. You can download it. Believe it or not, all the faculty here at the School of Engineering have to do these every year. So I brought a couple along from some of our faculty, and I thought you might get a kick out of seeing some of these. What's going on? Okay. Anyway, just wanted to show you a couple, and they roughly follow that format that we were just talking about. For example, here's one by Beer. Contact information. This is a little description of what he's doing. Accomplishments. And, for example, here's a pretty clever-looking artificial insect. And if you've worked with Beer, you know he does biorobots. Okay, so we have sort of a bug with a printed circuit. Actually, that's a neural network in it. And you don't have to have graphics. Here's one by Srinath. We've got JackStat people in here. You know, you can have alt text. There's nothing wrong with that. Okay, for those of you who are into chips, here's one by Garverick, and you can see, this is a wireless microfluidic sensor platform that he put in here, probably for getting data from sea slugs, if you're familiar with his work. And I think I have one or two more. White, here's stuff that he did purely on software. So for those of you doing purely software projects, you can get some ideas. And there's stuff here that is faculty, they have to do that you certainly don't have to do. So don't worry that you don't 100% follow the format. Here's one by Podgursky. And he put a graph down here. I think this is of testing Windows. And then finally, here's one from Branicky and approach accomplishments. And what he chose to highlight is one very specific thing. Like, for example, you know, maybe the gun target people might just happen to have a picture of their gun target exploding due to being hit by a bullet. That would be a pretty impressive photo to put in. I don't know. You know, it's like I said, it's what this is like a one-page executive summary in PowerPoint. And so you'll put that at the end of your five slides. And notice, most of this is cut and paste, so it shouldn't be too much work. Although, you know, you may want to be really, really creative and spend a lot of time. That's up to you. Now, what I want to talk about today, any questions on that quad chart? Okay, let's see. I want to talk about... Okay. I don't want to talk about PowerPoint. I want to talk about patents. You can't see it up there, but I want to talk about patent disclosures. This is the university form that Nick Ferlini was talking about, and hopefully that will go away. Okay, what I'm going to do is just basically go through each line of the form, okay? And it turns out, for our purposes, there's a form. The form is trivial to fill out. What's actually interesting is that for a patent, you have to provide a description of the work. And it ties in with what is patentable. So we'll talk about that. First of all, you need a title of your invention. You know, this could be the laser pointer for stimulating cats. Okay? From that discussion. And I don't know if there is any restriction on how long it can take. Okay? Then, here's the big thing. This is what you will be really working on. And this is not due until middle of November, so this is pretty early. Okay? Please attach description of technology. Now, not every senior project is patentable. We don't care. You know, the goal of this course is not to produce patents and get rich. Oh, that'd be cool. I have nothing against that. What our goal here is to understand this intellectual property because it's becoming more and more a commodity, just like product. And as I said last time, and Nick echoed it, many companies, their sole business isn't dealing in patents and other forms of intellectual property. They never actually produce anything in the sense that you produce a million iPods or something. Okay? Now, the description of the technology, one or two page summary description of the invention, well, that is, in some cases, a straight takeoff of your executive summary, but it's more. Okay? Your executive summary is usually a starting point. Why is it unique, or why does it represent an improvement over an existing technology? And I'm going to talk about this a little bit more, okay? That this is the whole business that Nick was talking about earlier, that it should not be obvious, you know? If you have a white iPod, a black iPod is pretty obvious, okay? On the other hand, if you have an original iPod and going to a video iPod is not necessarily obvious. Okay. That is probably patentable. And I'm sure Steve Jobs had a number of patents on that one. By the way, for
those of you who get Time magazine, you might want to look at, I think it was last week's issue, which does nothing but talk about, well, they have a lot of other articles, but the lead article was talking about Steve Jobs and the design environment at Apple. Steve, by the way, has no technical degree. He has no college degree. He has no MBA. And he's done rather well, at least in my opinion.
Okay. But the thing is, they have a tightly integrated design team and a corporate structure that does everything. You know, like Microsoft just does software, although they'd like to take over the world. Okay. But Apple does everything. They do operating systems. They do hardware. Now they're into music licensing. So they have a horizontal as opposed to a vertical organization. Okay. But anyway, that's just off on the side. But an improvement, like adding video, is probably patentable. Now, a description can include a drawing or a diagram or something. Now, that's what the university would like to see.
And, for example, I didn't bring it, but I have a patent disclosure that I think was 20 pages long. Most of it figures of how you might do things. Okay? For what you're going to do in this course, I'm going to be very surprised if anything we have is over 4 pages. It'll probably all be 3 pages. Very short. Okay? So this is not a very difficult assignment. And this is why they want a big description, because Nick's office would review real patent disclosures. They're going to go do the patent search. We're going to go make you do an initial patent search. And the idea will be to explore, is it unique or does it represent an improvement over existing technologies? Also, it turns out, for many of you, you'd never even consider looking up the patent database. Like, for example, I know one project in here, the gun target one, mentioned Caswell. Has a system out there on the market already. Much more expensive system. Well, I'll show you how you can go online and look up all of their patents which are published, and you can see what they do. And they have to, as Nick was saying in his lecture, explain the technology in the patent. Okay? Sometimes it gives you great insight on products as opposed to the technical papers that you find in most technical magazines. Okay. This is a big deal. You may not think so at the time, but this is what drives faculty and inventors to fights. Who gets credit for the invention? And by the way, this often means who gets the monetary credit for the invention. Now, if you're at GE or NASA or whatever, you turn it over to them, and you get some token honorarium if you're lucky. Maybe a certificate that you can put on the wall. Okay? But if you're a small company, this can be a really, really big deal. And in fact, the interesting thing is, what do you do if you're the guy at Texas Instruments who developed the integrated circuit? That was a pretty far-reaching patent. You know, I hope he got a lot more than $100. He did very well, including getting the Nobel Prize, which is almost unheard of for an engineer. There is no Nobel Prize in engineering, even though Nobel was an engineer. It's interesting. But anyway, inventor name and percent of contribution, that's the important thing. And on a team, you know, sometimes it may be, oh, one person came up with the idea, that the whole team share equally. And by the way, the team can include the people who reduced it to practice. What this means is, let's take a case of maybe like Norman's capacitive robotic communications. Someone came up with the idea, wouldn't it be great if we use capacitors to communicate? Well, it might be that the original idea was we string a capacitor between two robots, or maybe a whole row of them. Okay, but Norman was a brilliant case student out there, and he said, let's put the electrodes on the side, develop all the hardware, and reduce it to practice. That's an implementation. That's what reduced to practice is all about, making it work.
Okay? And by the way, the total contribution should not total more than 100%. That's on their instructions, so you can blame Nick for that. Okay. This is not, in fact, you won't do anything with this at all. This is more for graduate students. Because basically the university is a contract house. We get contracts from all kinds of agencies, public, private, whatever, with different regulations. So if we spent money to do the research and the development, we have to say, where did the money come from so that they can check into the legal issues with the funding organization? And that's what all of this is about. And if no funds were used, did you use university time? In other words, did you work on it at your job? And we talked about this a little bit in this lecture. Many times when you sign an employment contract with an organization, you sign away every thought. Every thought, no matter how far away it is from, you know, like in the case of GE. Well, actually, GE does everything, so I can understand that. Maybe a more narrow company like Microsoft, okay, and you come up with a new idea for a fuel cell while you're in the bathroom or something, okay? Microsoft has that because you're working for them and signed it away. Most companies will not enforce that unless it became hugely profitable, and then they'd remind you of the contract that you signed. So I point that out. But, again, you could probably almost ignore this. It basically, the university is saying, hey, if you use university time, you worked on it as part of your job, or you use university facilities, labs, equipment, etc., we get a fraction of it. Everyone is after their pound of flesh. But for your disclosure, a non-issue. Now, this ties in with what Nick was talking about when you tell people about your invention. And notice, the first thing is just when did you come up with it? This is like your lab notebook. Now, what's really hard is when you document, or how you document, when you came up with a software idea. I mean, when was the last time you saw a software engineer or a programmer with a notebook? Although, if you take a look, Moral and Technology Ogden walk around with lab notebooks all the time and break everything down. I believe that Andy Pedersen does somewhat similar. Although he's not as conscientious about it as the Ozzy Oddlers. Software people that want to patent their stuff should keep notebooks. It's not incompatible. But they don't seem to. The important thing is to have a traceable date. That's why the discussion was in some organizations, your notebook is initialed every day. Sometimes it's notarized. A really, really interesting case is the invention of the laser. Okay, which the original patent on the laser was issued to Towns and Shallow at Stanford. Okay, what's really funny is 20 years later, their graduate student sued them and got full control of the invention based on his lab notebooks. He claimed that he came up with the idea of the laser. He came up with the acronym, the name, laser. Light amplification for stimulated emission of radiation. He showed it in his notebook. And this guy was a real, notebook freak. He took his notebook down to the drugstore every Friday at Stanford and had it notarized. That's going to extremes. But he got the complete rights to the invention of the laser away from his faculty advisor by proving that he came up with the idea. Very interesting. Now, there's other things on here, but the first thing
And the most important is simply some hard documentation of when you came up with it. The first publication, okay? This can be notice, include theses, technical reports, and stuff, okay? And in your case, the first publication might be your interim technical report or even your proposal. Yes?
So in the case of software, electronic documentation doesn't matter.
Well, if you can figure out how to notarize it, you know, if they come in and put a stamp on it, that's the hard part. Because how can you prove it? And the best way is to have a witness that's signed in hard copy.
Do you have some sort of pervasive control system that you're not in control of, like for our project we're using reduction and diversity as testing and server?
Mm-hmm.
That possibly protect?
It's a better step, but the best thing would still be to have a log or something. Print it out, unfortunately, I hate to say it, but don't forget though. With software, we've talked about the issue of copyright versus patent. It's the fundamental idea that you want to make sure you document, and you don't necessarily need every code revision. It's the idea before you write the code down, unless you come up with it while you're typing. Okay? But for example, I have a funny feeling that someone came up with one-click shopping somewhere before they started writing the code for it. Same thing holds true for example, LZW algorithms for compression, security algorithms. That's reducing to practice. A lot of the coding is reducing to practice.
Just as a little kind of side note of whether we could possibly do it, email to an outside system.
Now that is possible.
Because those are now legal documents.
Well, up to a point.
They're bringing those in, and if, as long as you go to external systems, they will be time and date stamped for you.
Yes, although an enterprising person could go modify all of those. One of the things that we used to do was you'd write up, this was before all of email and stuff, this was snail mail. Basically, you'd write it up and send a letter to yourself, and it would be time stamped. By the federal government. But believe it or not, that's not adequate. So, the best thing is an impeccable witness that signs off on it. Now, notice, first publication, first public oral disclosure. You know, you can relate that to the kinds of things that go on in senior projects. And that's, for example, why we have certain projects among us that are very good, but they don't want to give an oral presentation in class and start the patent clock. Okay? There are important considerations. So this is actually important, and you could tie it in just simply first oral status report. This might or might not be presentation or something that occurred later on. You can be creative here. But the whole issue of documenting when you came up with an invention is easier said than done. The written witness record is the gold standard. Everything else will probably involve use of attorneys if it's really valuable. And they will end up getting all the money. Because, as Nick said, most inventions really don't make money. Now, let's see. They want to know if you actually reduced it to practice. In other words, do you have a working version that you can show someone? That's all this is. And notice, it's a checkbox. Now, you can actually do it, and this is what we most like to see, or you can say, here's how you would do it, and you don't bother doing it. As I said, there are companies that don't actually build anything, but they patent everything and tell people how to do it. And they make very good money. And all it is a checkbox. And then, of course, there's a bunch of junk down here at the bottom. Names, social security numbers. It turns out you cannot file a patent unless you include social security number and country of citizenship. It must have both pieces of information.
And it even tells you down here. Because you may not get any money back if they don't have that information. Okay. And that's really pretty much, I think, the big issues. Just a couple comments. What we're going to do in here, which is going to be a little bit different, you know, that section two, which was describe your invention, we're going to actually take over a little bit of Nick Verlini's job. And what we want you to do is figure out whether what you're doing could actually be patented. And notice, any new or useful process can be patented. Okay? And this just gets into different definitions and stuff. But new or useful. For example, if you're using a Seiko kinetic locking mechanism to power a pacemaker, that's probably something new and useful. Now, when we get into things like monitoring the temperature profile in the FSAE vehicle, you know, that's, you have to ask yourself, well, is it new or useful other than for a very narrow research range of activities? On the other hand, if you're working with performance vehicles, maybe the military wants it. Or maybe it would be great for monitoring aircraft landing wheels or something like that. There may be all kinds of applications.
It's very interesting. If you just go back and look through the patent database,
most of the early inventions, at least a lot of them, seem to relate to wheels. All kinds of wheels. Just a comment, the 1 year. You have 1 year after any disclosure to apply for your patent. Otherwise, it becomes public domain. Now, this I'm not going to spend as much time on because I want to hurry up and actually do some patent searching. Okay? If it's obvious, like I said, changing color, okay, it's not patentable. It's got to be sufficiently different. What is sufficiently different? That is usually what you actually argue with the patent examiner. You will write up your patent. You'll send it to the patent examiner. The patent examiner will probably spend like 10 or 15 hours doing various research and then listing all the reasons why it's not patentable. And in fact, they almost always do that. They contest it to see that if you can come up with an argument, it's forcing you to do the argument for them. Okay? And by the way, that there are some pretty good jobs as patent examiners. Now, here's the more useful thing, because you can use it right now in your project, patent searching. Okay? And I think what I'm going to do is just get out of this stuff and bring up a browser, and we'll go take a look at USPTO.gov. USPTO, United States Patent and Trademark Office. There's really not very much to it. Anything new up here?
No.
And there's all kinds of strange things that you can do. Okay. There's all kinds of stuff that you can do on here, but most of it you can skip. The only thing that's useful is, well, maybe I shouldn't be quite that all-inclusive. The most useful thing here for your purposes is this little button here called Search. And it brings up, as you can tell, an extremely complicated web page. Okay? There's only a couple things on here at the moment which are really, really useful. And by the way, these are the issued patents. These are patents which are published, which means that they're in the process of being granted. And you can search, and here are the three types of searches. You can do a patent number search. This is really cool if, for example, if you pick up a box, it's got a number on it, and you have the patent information, and you just want to go check. Okay? And that's why, for example, I think I told the story, I picked up a motion sensing light, wanted to know how it worked, checked the patent number, and the patent number was for the hinge and the bracket of how it attached to the wall. Okay? That might be called deception in advertising, but you never know what you're going to get, and I'll show you how to do that. The quick search is really very similar to the IEEE search. You can search by words in the patent. You can search by who owns the patent. You can search by number or combinations. Now, you can only do, as I recall, two combinations. The advanced search basically lets you write Boolean searches, and you can make them as complicated as you want. So let's just do a really trivial patent number search. Okay, someone give me a number between 0 and 7 million. Oh, I've already checked up one. Come up with something in the middle. At least 5 or 6 digits. Come on. Oops. What was it?
4405829.
And let's see. Cryptographic communications system and method. Boy, where did you pull that off? Oh, okay. And boy, this is a fairly mathematical one. That's a little rare. Okay. And this, by the way, it's a more recent. It's 1983. So you have the text. And you can go through. And it was granted, by the way, to a bunch of these folks working at MIT. Okay. Which means MIT owns it. And then here's the useful part of patents. It references another patent, which you can go click on and see what it is. It references articles, and there's all kinds of other stuff, claims, okay? And all of this is about modulo numbers and coding. Now, earlier patents, I think it's about 1979 that the system changes. Early patents are only available as image scans. They don't have any text, and that's where you have to go up above to images. Okay, but that was an interesting one. You see the information you can start to get. This is a useful database. You know, the closer you are to a product, like you may want to go and look up all the golf carts that people have ever done. That would be a scary thought. But why don't you give me a smaller number, and one that will come up pure images, and we'll take a look at it. Okay, come on, let me get out of this stupid thing. Whoops. Oh, well, good enough. Okay, someone, just pick a random number. 10,000. That's going to be an early one. Okay, let's see what it is. And you see, for anything before about 1979, you'll get this message, and you go click on images. And what you do is you get one page at a time. Now, by the way, there's all kinds of shareware out there for grabbing all the multiple pages at once and downloading it and making a PDF. And, oh.
You don't have a zip
drive. Oh, that could be. Darn it. This would bring up a full image. And, boy, I'm sort of now bummed out to know what it was. Well, you can go try it on your own time. Let's go back and actually go do a quick search and see the difference. Whoops. Okay, quick search is a little bit different. You see, this looks a lot like the IEEE database search. And notice, you can do two queries with and, or and not. Okay, so you're setting up some simple Booleans. The fields that you can pick are a lot. Like, for example, actually, I haven't done this recently. I think my stuff is on the pending side, but let's see. Let's try inventor name. We'll do merit. And we'll just search. And that should come up with a few.
Yeah. Boy, I don't know about this one. Apparatus for de-aerating and vacuuming packing with tight closing anti-pollution device. And a skin protection lotion. Doesn't look like mine. The rest of the others look... oh, there's one. I think that one's my brother's. Yeah, forward projection for a... Yep. Now, what you can do, which makes it much more useful, is let's suppose we want it to look for, what is it? Caswell? Is that the name of the company? Is that the right spelling? And we would look at assignee. Now, let's see, where is it? Assignee name. And let's see if that works. This is a case where you would know the name of a company, and you could start looking. Oh, I don't know. Oh, dueling interactive target system? Do they shoot at each other? I'm not sure. Well, that's true. If the target shot back, it would make it a lot more interesting. And here's stuff about sensors and a conductor and impact targets. And this is the text. There's a ton of related patents. You know, so that's very interesting. You can, for example, let's try. Okay. Let's go into the abstract. Let's see if we come up with, this was a hotly contested issue. Believe it or not. I may have not have done deep fat right. It might not be hyphenated. All right. Oh, look at this. Deep fat fryers. Process for forming a potato patty. I mean, you're never sure about what gets patented.
What is the process?
You really want to know. Okay. Let's see. Why would you want to patent it? I have no idea. Did you know that they're made from cooked or blanched shredded potatoes and a natural potato binder? I think that means Elmer's glue. Okay, and I'm not quite sure. It provides a, it's the amylose component of the starch. Minimizes adhesiveness. Okay. And let's see, somehow you get a cohesive potato patty that can be deep fat fried. And notice, it'll highlight the words that it found. This is like any other search engine. You may not know the right words to begin with. You have to play with it a little bit. Is that a question?
So does McDonald's have to pay royalties for making hash browns?
They might, but I believe that the very first McDonald's French fry patent is dated by 1956. In fact, we're almost out of time, but let's try McDonald in assignee name. I'm not sure if it would be McDonald's. And we'll just get rid of this one. Whoops. How do I... That's fine. Now let's see what comes up, if anything. Because I'm not quite sure how McDonald's is spelled by the government. Yes. By patent numbers in current U.S. classification. So there's a restriction there. Oh, boy, look at that first one. It cleans tough oil grease and rubber grime. I have no idea what that is. Universal cleaner. Well, don't forget, like I said, I don't know how to spell McDonald's. So, do we see something here that looks like it is McDonald's?
Yeah,
No, the personal use syringe is not McDonald's. No. Yeah. How many did it? Okay. Let's see. Let's get the last 17. The problem was, obviously, I didn't know how they spelled McDonald's. Maybe it was... Maybe we can just try it. Yeah, that's what I'm thinking. A combined calendar memo and pencil holder. By the way, if you see a D in front, that is a design patent. For example, there's a design patent just on what the iPod looks like. Then there would be separate patents on what's in it. Multiple stacking letter tray. Let's try McDonald's, the whole shoot match. But this can be a very, very useful resource to find things. This sounds more like it. That's got to be McDonald's. They patented the salad bar? It's a design patent. That's what it looks like. But here is a food plate package. McDonald's Corporation having a top plate, top cover, and a bottom plate for temporary storage of prepared food. And I wish we had the viewer in. But with the viewer, you get to see all the pictures of the invention. Look at this. They're telling you completely how it's built. This is what Nick was talking about when he said that you have to do the disclosure of the best way to implement the invention to your knowledge. And so this will be a complete recipe about how you build it, how you do everything related to it. So, for example, for a lot of your projects, this is often better than going to the IEEE database. The IEEE database tends to be very researchy. This tends to be driven by people who are producing products. And there will be a lot of instructions which you can access on how you build one. Okay. So, next week, oral status reports again. Hopefully it's not a lot of work this time, but you will have to make one new slide, and that's mostly cutting and pasting. I don't think many of you have a lot of new work since last week. But if you do, that's great. Okay. We'll see you next Monday.